is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network Studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Well, Happy New Year, everyone. Can you believe it? It's 2020. Now, this is very exciting day for me. I always, of course, book well in advance, especially my first program of the year. I wanted to have somebody really great, and I kept putting it off. I had the date open, and it's not like me to leave it to the last minute. I was really, at one point I said, you're crazy, you've got to book somebody, but I was holding out because I wanted somebody special. I wanted somebody, not just a New York Times best-selling author. I wanted somebody who would be inspirational. So I was so happy that this author, she's an author, but she's also an inspiration. I met her at BoucherCon. I was so impressed with her, and I am so thrilled to welcome to Joy on Paper, Kara Brookins. Hi, Kara.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm so happy that you are on the program. You know, I mentioned to you, as soon as I got back from BoucherCon, the day I got back, I sent you an email because I was impressed. You know, we had a chance to chat a little there on the couch, and I got to see you in action there in BoucherCon. And I was so impressed with you, and I so wanted to get you on the program, but of course you had so many things going on in your life, and I almost gave up hope. And then, but for some reason, I just kept this open. I kept this day open. I said, somebody's going to come, somebody who's really important, and somebody who can inspire my listeners. And then you contacted me. So I just want to thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here, and you've inspired me right back. I have been listening to some of your stuff on iTunes, so, you know, we all need that little push, and what a great way to start the year.
It is. It is. My listeners know that I really enjoyed going to Dallas and just being involved in BoucherCon, and one of the things that, when I came back, I told people, you know, when you go to these events and there are thousands of people, everybody sort of, the faces all get mixed up and you're not sure who's who. And, you know, you have these name labels and you're trying to keep track of everybody. But there are always a few people who stand out, a few people who they rise above everything. And you were one of those for me. There was Andrew Grant was there, and of course he stood out because he's like 6'7" or something like that. Yeah, you can't miss that guy. And then there was absolutely adorable Alistair Kimball, and he looks like he stepped out of a noir movie. You know, yeah. He was delightful. And then a really charming woman from Vancouver, Kathy Ace, she was always wearing sort of flowy, colorful dresses, so you couldn't miss it. And then there's you, dressed in red, and the most important thing, smiling, always smiling. It was just a joy to look at you.
Well, thank you. You know, I always have this sort of extreme level of optimism, and I think I was born with that, and I continue to carry it, and it has served me well, but it's gotten me in a bit of trouble. You know, I think if you start every day thinking it's going to be fantastic, it can keep you in some bad situations, which it definitely has in my life. But most of the time, it serves me well. I really do feel like every day is going to go well. And when you go in with that attitude and a big mug of coffee, it usually is.
Oh, that coffee, that's important to me, too. Well, you've written 8 books. Well, let's start with the one that probably you're most famous for. It's called Rise, How a Family Built a House. And this is an amazing story. We're going to talk about that. We'll talk about your speaking and all of this. And later on, I want to talk to you about your other books because I love time shifter books. And so we'll talk about those too.
Oh.
Okay? So
great.
Let's start. You are now I think a major public speaker, and it comes about because of this. Well, the book comes about because of something that you did, really quite amazing. And you have to tell us about Rise. And what did you do? You are known as the woman who built a house. I mean, you know, with four kids' help, but you know, you built a house.
Yes. You know, I think that so often we find ourselves in places where we did not expect to be. And the public speaking certainly fits into that for me. I was a computer programmer and a writer, so you can't be more behind the keyboard and off the stage than that. So I'm very surprised to find myself on stages now. And the same goes for building a house. That is not a place I ever expected to be. But as, you know, as a single mom with four kids, I had left a really bad domestic violence situation and a stalking situation. So my kids and I needed a place to live. And that's how that project began. It began with this idea of, we don't have very much money. We need a place to land. You know, what are our options? And our options were buying a small house and cramming into it and trying to fix it up, or buying all of the supplies to build a house and just doing it ourselves. And it started exactly like that, and literally YouTubing every single step of how to run gas lines, how to build a foundation, you know, how to raise a wall. So very, very unexpected place to land, but it was life-changing, not just in, from a financial aspect and from a physical and security aspect of having a safe place to live, but taking four kids from 2 years old to 17 years old, and kids who didn't know how to communicate, kids who had very low self-esteem and had lived in fear for a decade, and letting them literally build themselves a better life. Extremely, extremely profound change in our family.
And a major house, not just a little house, 3,400 square feet. I mean, like, okay, you know, some people would be happy with 1,200. So it is so amazing. Many people have seen, of course, that wonderful Cary Grant movie where Mr. Blandings builds his dream house. And I think your house must be about the size, that must be about the same size. But he had lots of people working for him. Wow.
The size of the house always makes us laugh, because it kind of came about for two reasons. One, we drew the house plans ourselves. So if you hand your kids a pencil and ask them to draw exactly the house they want, it gets really big really fast. And you know, they keep moving the margins on their rooms and pushing those walls out. But also, you know, we didn't know how to build a small house, in that some of the rooms that we ended up with, you know, we had started with a little bit more complex house plan, and it kept sort of getting squared off, you know, because building strange roof lines and insets and knee walls was more complex than I could figure out. So we would modify the house plans as we went to a simpler form that we were able to build. So, yeah, we built a big one because we couldn't figure out how to build a small one.
It is beautiful. Now, over the years, my husband was, he's an engineer, but several times I helped him build, like, when he had problems with workers, I sort of stepped in and helped him build, you know, the garage or something, but nothing like this. I mean, this is major. And when you think about it, when people imagine, as you said, you had them draw it, for goodness sakes, and then you got the materials, and YouTube was just starting at that time, right?
About that. Yes. I've actually lived in the house for 11 years. So this was 2007 when the idea was conceived, and we started building the end of 2007, the beginning of 2008, and YouTube was brand new. And it was as a computer programmer, something that I had already started to rely on, just because we were Googling every step of you know, cutting-edge technology. But it was the first time that we could find videos of how to do things. Now, the videos were these sort of blurry, you know, none of us had smartphones, of course, so they were these blurry videos that people had taken with the low-resolution video cameras that we had at the time and posted on YouTube. So they were not YouTube personalities like we have today. YouTuber wasn't even a word. And it was just him doing something. So it was a really fascinating idea that anything you wanted to do in life, you could find videos for. And we would start out by Googling, you know, how to lay a foundation block. And we would watch a dozen videos of how to lay a foundation block and then come out to the job site and kind of ask each other, so do you remember how they did this part? You know, and throw ideas back and forth. And ideas that my 11-year-old had were just as valid as mine or as my 17-year-old or 15-year-old, because she'd watched the same YouTube videos. So yeah, it was just sort of muddling through it like that and slowly gathering the skills of, once you've pounded in a few nails or you've cut a few pieces of board, you become more confident and you come up with more ideas of how to do the next step. And it was just a whole lot of figuring it out.
And did people come along and say, you're crazy? I mean, this is crazy.
Yeah, right from the start, a lot of people told me I was crazy. Right from the start, it didn't feel crazy to me. It felt like looking at the facts, looking at the financial position I was in, looking at the emotional position my kids were in. I sort of laid everything out, you know, paper things out, and looked at everything, and I thought, well, obviously, the most logical conclusion is that we'll build a house. And I honestly thought that any person in my position would have come to the same conclusion. Now I can see it was kind of crazy, but at the time, it felt like a logical thing. And when I called my parents, who were big DIYers, my parents were divorced, so I had to call each of them separately. And both of them were like, no, this is a terrible idea. What are you thinking? And I was just stunned that they thought that, because to me, it was just so obviously the right conclusion. And along the way, of course, you know, bank inspectors and loan officers, because I did have to get a construction loan to buy all the supplies for the house. They all, you know, vocalized that I was a bit nuts for doing this, but it didn't feel that way. And I felt like we had the skills. We had done some small DIY projects. I felt like we had the skills. Of course I was wrong. And of course we were in over our head right from the start. But I had also set it up as a situation. I felt like this was not just the best option, but I felt like it was our only option to pull ourselves out of this really downward negative slope that we were in from, you know, from every direction. So I set it up as the only way out, meaning I spent every penny I had on the supplies for the house. So we ended up with this mountain of 2x4s and pipes and bathtubs. And the only way out of that was to turn it into a house. We had no money left to hire anybody. So when you really put yourself in that situation of no plan B, I have to make this work, it's amazing what you can push yourself to do. Well, that and 20-hour workdays.
That's amazing. What I was going to say. It's a lot of work to build a house and with a construction crew, for goodness sakes. And then you and the kids are doing it. Now, what did you find the most challenging, the plumbing or the carpentry?
I was probably most afraid of the gas lines, gas lines. I couldn't believe they let me pull the permit for that. And I, you know, of course, that felt like pretty high stakes because I felt like I was going to blow us up. but I found out, and how I did all of that was just asking a lot of questions, you know, at the hardware store from people who worked there, and also from just random strangers who happened to have the bad luck of standing next to the gas lines at the same time that I was buying things, you know, buying black pipes. So I would ask everybody questions. I would ask the inspector questions, the city inspector, the bank inspector, when they came by to inspect things. I would say, okay, what are you going to inspect next, and how do you inspect it? So that, you know, I would have a really good idea how I could run a preliminary test before that. But really, I think the most difficult part of the house was the foundation, partly because I was really realizing the scope of how far in over my head I was. The foundation, I did a block and fill foundation, and without going into a lot of detail, that was 1,500 of the big gray concrete blocks stacked up, and then I filled them with a powdered granite so that we have a slab that's raised off the ground nearly 8 feet in the front of the house. So that's a lot of concrete block. That's a lot of masonry work for somebody who has never laid a brick in their life. And the just carrying, you know, I was a 110-pound computer programmer just carrying and moving 1,500 guac and moving them more than once because I put them all in the wrong place the first two times we moved them. You know, and realizing what that was like in the freezing cold in December by Little Rock, Arkansas, where I built the house. You know, it was just brutally hard work, and how slow the process was. You know, on paper, the timeline that I had written out for how I would accomplish everything within the span of my 9-month construction loan, because that's all the bank had given me was 9 months. How far behind I was right from the start, mostly because of my own lack of knowledge, you know, my own lack of muscle, and my own cowardice at some points of not moving ahead, you know, procrastinating stuff that I would need to do in order to move it faster. So, yeah, it was brutally hard right from the start.
But you did it. It's still, for me, having watched many houses go up, for me, the thought that you did it in 9 months is really quite incredible.
And yeah, you know, my son visited, my oldest son came and visited for Christmas, and he and I pulled down a closet door in my bedroom because it was swinging into an area I didn't want it, and we hung up a duo, like, barn door, you know, sliding door thing, and we made so many mistakes, and we're laughing at ourselves. And, you know, at one point I was like, do you think we need to all evacuate the house? Because if we cannot even hang up the sliding door without making 12 mistakes, I'm a little worried about the house standing up, you know? But we passed every inspection. The house is fine. But it's just this idea of we didn't know what we were doing, and you don't have to. You have to be willing to make those mistakes. And we made those when we were building the house. We still make those mistakes when we're putting stuff together. And we're not afraid to make them and throw something on the bonfire if we have to. And then, you know, tear it down and get it right. And, you know, that's how you do anything, from writing a book to building a house to any new thing that you do. If you're not afraid to look a little bit ridiculous standing on a stage the first time with no clue how this is supposed to turn out, if you kind of can lose the ego in the things you do and be willing to mess it up and ask a lot of questions, you literally can accomplish anything.
Well, I love what you have on the front of your webpage where you say, I help people do hard things. And, you know, from this experience of working with your children as a real team, I mean, this is teamwork. You certainly, yes. Oh boy, you know, I was a homeschool mom, so we did a lot of things together, a lot of projects, made things, did things, went places. But this, putting the kids, you know, as a construction team, this is amazing. And they, of course, learned as you had to. You had to persevere because otherwise you wouldn't have a roof over your head. So now you've taken this knowledge and you're putting it into talking to people and helping them. So tell us some of the things that, you know, when it's always, you know, nice to tell people, well, just work hard and do this and do this. But what are some of the practical things that you're telling people? I know that you do a lot of public speaking. So anyone out there who has a group or an event, they should go to your website and book you, because you are, as I said, even at BoucherCon, you were inspirational. So tell us some of your ideas for people.
Oh, sure. You know, and the reason I put that on my website about hard things is because I quickly learned that the lessons that I learned building the house and the things that my kids learned, it really was something that could apply to everything that we did for the rest of our lives, and that the same lessons could be applied to everybody else's life. Whatever hard thing you're facing, we still have the same tendencies to procrastinate, the same tendencies to be afraid of looking like we don't know what we're doing, and the tendency to want to know all of the details and feel like we have to have a high level of expertise before we try things. So a big part of what I share with people is just that willingness, like I was just talking about, to fail. Be willing to leap into something and fall flat on your face, because it's a huge part of the learning process. It's a huge part of the confidence process. And that whole, you know, faking it until you figure it out is how we built the house. And it wasn't faking skills. You can't fake skills. You have to learn the skills. You know, so if you don't know how to use a power saw, if you've never used a power saw in your life, please do not start building a house. Learn how do you do the small skills, you know, all of the things that will add up. But you don't have to know how it's all going to fit together. You can jump in and figure it out and stand back up every time you fail. And, you know, a big part of the procrastination is, you know, that's another big problem that we all have. And, you know, starting with creating very specific processes and good habits for how you're going to tackle things. And, you know, it ends up being a much more simple process than we all put it out there as. And so, you know, that's sort of it in a nutshell. Of course, there's lots more specific processes based on, you know, like especially with teamwork, I use sort of a mission command style. My kids and I weren't out here as me knowing how to build a house and telling them how to do every step. It was very much trusting one another as a team and learning how to communicate as a team and to listen to each other's ideas, the good and the bad, and having the trust in each other that when we threw out a bad idea, nobody was going to destroy us for it. You know, that trust that we had each other's backs, and that together we could figure it out. Because everything from writing a novel to building a house to starting a business or working on a project requires a team of people.
And this motivation, and also you have to find the confidence in you. If you're going to succeed.
That's right. And, you know, I don't think that you have to start out with the confidence. You have to start out with not necessarily with the confidence that you're going to succeed, but the confidence that you are willing to try and give it everything you've got. As you know, there is no way by the end of this process that we were not going to end up with a house. You know, we gave it everything we had. And I think that the idea of sabotaging your plan B, you know, like I said, I spent all of the money on the supplies, so there was one way out of this, and that was to build a house. You know, I set all of my goals that way now. A little over a year ago, about a year and a half ago, I walked away from my day job, and I said, you know, I can't work the writing job and the computer programming job and the speaking job. It's just too much. I'm going to put everything I've got into one. So I walked away from the day job and went into speaking full time, and I had no plan B. Certainly, I'd created a bit of a safety net for myself, and you know, I wasn't just going to end up on the streets. And book number two in the series be how I lost the house I built. You know, I wasn't that reckless. It's not about making reckless decisions, but about making these calculated decisions with, I am going to pull the rug out from under myself, and I've set this up for myself, and I am going to make it work. And that we have the tendency to always say, well, I'm going to give this thing a try, and if it doesn't work, then I'm okay with this other smaller thing. And I think that that's a really dangerous habit that we've gotten into, and we don't only do it with ourselves, but we do it with each other. We tell each other, oh, be careful with that big goal. You don't want to set yourself up for failure. And, you know, I think it's a dangerous mindset that holds us back. So making these huge, enormous goals, putting everything into it, and, you know, you only fail if you quit. So keep going. Keep going till you get there.
Now, of course, the book attracted a lot of, you know, attention, and people, of course, have said it should be a movie. Are we going to see a movie about this?
Oh boy, Hollywood is a messy place, let me tell you.
Yeah, I know. I worked there. I wrote scripts, so that's why I'm saying I hope that we see it. It takes time, though, and people are always like, yes, it's going to happen. But you go into these turnaround things, but I hope that they're progressing.
Yes. You know, we did sell the option on the film, and it was assigned to the studio, which is fantastic. I have producers that I love, escape artists with Jason Blumenthal, Steve Tisch, David Bloomfield, Todd Black, you know, great producers. They did The Pursuit of Happiness with Will Smith. They recently did The Equalizer with Denzel Washington. So, you know, they're fantastic people, and I've really enjoyed working with them. And also a great scriptwriter. I co-wrote the script with Kate Angelo. She wrote some of Will and Grace, and she did The Backup Plan with Jennifer Lopez, and Sex Tape with Cameron Diaz. I've worked with fantastic people. Writing a script about your life is one of the most difficult things you could ever do, you know, because, of course, you're fictionalizing part of your life and pulling in real elements that are very difficult to think of putting on the big screen. You know, you have to be very humble and, you know, understand that the toughest parts of your life, the parts of your life that you are probably the least proud of, are what you're about to display to the world. So we've gotten that far in the process. And also, again, I said we have studio, which is great. And we've had major A-list actress attached to the script as a producer, as well as to play me, which is super exciting. Because the studio hasn't announced it, I don't share her name publicly, but there are photos on my website. Everybody can probably figure out who that person is. And so that's where we are. And one of the problems is having an A-list actress means a crazy busy schedule for her, and lining everything up with the producer schedules, directors, the actress, the studio money.
Oh, I know. I've been through it. I've both done scripts for people's books, and I've also had my own scripts, optioned in Hollywood. So I know we go into turnaround, and sometimes it just drives us crazy. And when I of course read the book and read the story, I realized I assume they're looking at it as a feature film, but I would love to see it as a streaming video. It's sort of an ongoing. Really, to learn more about the process, I think people would enjoy it much if it was a streaming video, like an 8-part series at least. So we get to sort of see the kids and get to know them better, that you really don't get in a feature film. It's over too fast, and I think everybody, people, because in this day and age, people love this, you know, construction. And to have a real story, to have a real streaming video type of film about it. So talk to your people about it. That might go over better than just one motion picture, because one motion picture comes and goes. But a streaming video, they'll be playing that over and over, and you could run it for 8 episodes or 16 episodes, and I think that would be more fun. I'm just telling you.
I like the idea, although, like, writing the script for one movie was so brutally difficult that that makes me tired to think of writing 8 of them.
No, it's actually easier because you have so much you can show. People will just love I assume you got into some adventures during the construction process.
Oh, many. You know, and you can imagine it's a bit of a comedy, right?
Yeah.
You know, to have a woman and 4 kids. There's a 2-year-old on the construction
I'm telling you, this is really... Your story is really meant for streaming, not for a major motion picture. That's my opinion. If I was in charge, if I was optioning you, I would have, simply because whenever you have 4 kids, it's delightful. And whenever you have 4 kids getting into messes, it's delightful. Just the scene of them drawing, you know, in Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House, Cary Grant and his wife, you know, they make changes to the architectural drawings. And that's, that scene alone is so funny. But in your case, with all of you designing and squaring, I assume that you got a little bit messy, a little bit dirty.
Oh, very, yes.
Yeah, there were.
Yes, and a toddler who's potty training, streaking naked across the construction site regularly, you know, tossing clothes in the air. Oh. It was, of course, it was a comedy, but then you also had these, you know, and this was a big part of writing the script, figuring out who the audience is and which direction you're going with the script, because we also had a lot of horror.
Yeah.
You know, we had endured a lot of really horrific things, so we had all of these different dynamics. And I did speak with, you know, I had a number of different producers reach out to me that wanted to do the script, everything from, you know, from Disney to true horror level, you know, type pitches. So I talked to a lot of producers before I picked the escape artist to do this. And part of that was because of The Pursuit of Happiness and the way that they had adapted that film. as well as, you know, a lot of the others that are in their library. But, you know, and I also talk to, and this is probably more in the level of what you're discussing, is I had 50, and I've lost track, I think it's 57 now, reality television producers reach out to me about doing a reality show, which we had originally decided to do, and then instead decided to do the film. And so I have a holdback on my reality rights until after the film release. Yeah. And of course, then if for any reason the option falls through on the film, I can do the reality show. And that would be more in the style of, well, one of the producers that I was working with did a television series called Extreme Makeover Home Edition. So it would be more in the line of doing a reality HGTV style show, not necessarily for that
well,
network.
You know, getting a feature film done in Hollywood is not easy. I'm just going to say that. But because there's such a demand now for streaming video, I mean, I would love to see something. I know that there are, part of the book is very heavy and very hard, and it's it's tough. But then there's so much that would be conducive to something, sort of a combination of Please Don't Eat the Daisies, which also had some tough things, but the fun of seeing something being created and the fun of seeing, and I think it would be inspirational for young people to see something like that where they see, wow, this family worked together. And so many families out there aren't working together. They're not doing anything. The kids are sitting around with their devices, and the parents are doing this, and nobody's. But to see something like this in streaming, to see a family working together and building, I think it's a beautiful story. That's why when I saw you there, and I thought, she's so inspirational just in her attitude. When you can stand out, and you did, when there were, I think, 1,800 people there, and I'm sure that everybody who came across you remembered you and were inspired by you because you were cheerful and smiling and optimistic. And I think it would just be a great thing if we could find, you know, somebody who would play that on a streaming video. That's my opinion.
Oh, yeah, and I like the idea a lot. Who knows? That may be exactly where we end up.
I hope so.
And like you said, Hollywood is a tough business.
It is.
And it's a frustrating business because, well, you know, obviously I'm not a person who sits still well. And I've told the producers that many times, and they're like, oh, it's just to sit and wait now. We have to wait for this, wait for that. And I'm like, I don't do that.
Yeah, I know.
I don't sit and wait.
It is hard.
And, you know, I think that as a society, that's one of the things that we most need to work on, in that I think if you watch all of the best coming of age stories, they're all about taking action. And we have become a society that sits around and talks about things at the most. You know, we don't get up and take that physical action. And especially as part of a recovery or healing, and we've all gone through something, right? You know, we all have gone through some tough things that we have trouble moving past and that make us feel stuck in this sort of mote of sadness or loss or just uncertainty. I know my life could be better than it is right now, but I just don't know how to take the first step to get there. And for me, it's always about do something physical. And when the kids and I, you know, had come out of these really difficult circumstances, I knew that's what we needed. We didn't know how to talk to each other. We didn't know how to relate to each other. We had sort of a formal relationship because we were all just struggling to get through each day. And we had all of these walls, these, you know, survival walls built up emotionally that we didn't know how to just let that down and communicate. So when I first realized that, I thought, well, we have to go out and run a marathon together, or we have to climb a mountain, or, you know, something like that. But I don't like to run at all.
You know? Oh, no, I just so love to carry.
I knew that I needed my physical thing to be something that in the end I had something tangible. And, you know, the fact that we also needed a house meant that thing for us was a house. And for other people, that thing can be something entirely different. But I think that it's really important that it is something, you know, some sort of physical action that you do. And again, too often people think that this has to be an eat, pray, love journey that I do alone. Well, it's pretty rare for somebody to have gone through something in total isolation. And your future is not going to be in total isolation. So, you know, find people who either will be going through things in the future with you or have gone through things in the past with you that you can do that physical action together. And that is life-changing, life-building. It's the most important thing we did. And there's just a whole lot of power between hitting things really hard with a hammer and, you know, slicing through ginormous pieces of wood. And in the end, standing there and looking up at something you did that is towering over you, that's that much bigger than you are. What a sense of accomplishment and power.
Wow. And to see your children, how proud they are of what, you guys have done together. And have any of them decided to go into building construction?
None of them are in construction. My oldest son is a broadcast engineer. So he has, you know, a little bit of that geek side that I had with the programming. And he does want to build his own house, but he will, you know, be assisting with parts of it and supervising most of it. He will probably hire done. And of course, anytime he's like, well, when we build my house, I want to do this. I'm like, obviously, I have to show up, you know, turnabout's fair play in that game. He built my house. I'm going to have to build his. And my youngest son, who was only 2 when we built the house, occasionally thinks he wants to build a house. Because he doesn't know the reality of what that was like. But the girls want to have houses built. They don't want to just move into a house. They want to have the control and the flexibility of building what they want. Yeah, they want to do it in the way that you point while other people are doing most of the work. But that said, we constantly are doing projects. You know, like I just mentioned, we just hung up these doors in my bedroom. My den right now has like pictures piled everywhere. I'm doing this art project where I have a bunch of canvases I'm working on at once, kind of dodging back and forth between multiple canvases to do a graffiti art project for my youngest son's room. He's 14 now. And, you know, so there are always these big projects from, you know, yard work to gardening. I grow teas and herbs and, you know, we're always doing something very hands-on, very physical. Not a lot of TV watching at our house, so we're still constantly doing things. But none of us are building neighborhoods or anything.
Well, people have to go to your website because they can see there some photos of the construction period, and I think it's just so you did a fantastic job.
Well, thank you. It's a big house. I'm sitting in the library now, which was one of the most important things for me. I needed to have a library as a writer. So I have a full floor-to-ceiling library that's where I work every day now. I love to spend time here. It's a big 5-bedroom house, which feels empty sometimes now with my youngest son here. But yeah, it's really fantastic. It's an incredible thing. And I still share a lot of the projects that I do. I do Instagram stories. And just recently started to post those to Facebook also. So, you know, I share whatever crazy projects I'm working on now and kind of the process of what I'm doing. And sometimes it's a total fail. Sometimes I share, here I am at Hobby Lobby, here's what I'm buying. And later on, here's me pitching it on a fire out back because that didn't work. But, you know, it's just kind of sharing the everyday.
Well, the name of the website is Cara Brookins. CaraBrookins.com. People should really go to this website. It's fascinating. I think the entire story is fascinating. It's great to see these photos, and you know, and of course the books are available on Amazon and wherever books are sold. But the wonderful thing too is that in addition to this, you're an author of a series of other books. Tell us about your series, which I loved the name. The minute I came across them, I said, oh, I love this. Mark of the Spider.
Yeah, I started as a fiction writer, and that is where I thought I would always stay. I never imagined writing about my real life. And when I first started writing, it was to write for my children. I wrote a couple of historical fiction books set during the Depression, when my kids were in middle school, and then a geeky robot book, of course, bringing in my programming background, when they were in middle school. And then as young adults, I wrote a Time Shifter series, which is about time travel. I had a blast writing that. And that is the Mark of the Centipede, Mark of the Spider, and Mark of the Serpent. And you know, that is time travel, but it's time travel with, you know, ancient people built a time capsule. And a modern-day young guy has to take that back to the past to save the humans of the future. So I got to write about dinosaurs and steampunk societies, and as well as really primitive, you know, traveling back to three different eras in history. So I had a really good time writing that. And then my kids kind of grew up, so I wrote my first adult fiction book, which was a suspense novel, Little Boy Blue. And that one I'm actually looking at turning into a television series. I just pulled that from the publisher, the book from the publisher, in order to look at writing that as a TV series. So in fiction, I did what no fiction writer should do. I wrote in every genre for every age group, which maybe displays a little bit of my, we can call it either lack of focus or my I love everything problem. So, you know, I have too many interests and too many curiosities. So, you know, I expressed that probably in a way that was not super helpful for a writing career. But I had a lot of fun doing it and have now found ways moving forward of a better way to keep a consistent audience but write about a lot of different things. So, you know, in the future, I will probably eventually write more young adult, but focusing mostly on adult fiction at this time.
Well,
and for TV, that's my new thing. Because I've made so many contacts in Hollywood and working on the film, and it's a fascinating new world for me, and obviously I like a challenge and I like new things, I'm doing two TV pilots right now, one for the suspense, Little Boy Blue, and then one that is about a divorce attorney and voodoo dolls. So a little bit of wicked comedy fun for that one. But so yeah, that's where the writing goes. But most of my time now is speaking. I speak to organizations all over the world. Everything from straight up motivational keynote speaking to trainings in, you know, with companies like YouTube and Google for teamwork and leadership training and, you know, how to get unstuck sorts of presentations. And taking stories of the kids and I building the house and using those to teach, you know, basic principles of teamwork, leadership, and just keeping going.
And among the groups that you speak to, you speak to authors. And so what's some advice that you give to authors?
You know, with authors, I think that we have this idea of... or I did, certainly, and I know that others do, of patience, you know, for being published, and patience for working on a book. I think that authors need to light a little bit more of a fire under themselves for the work that they do, and hold themselves to some stricter deadlines, not only for their writing, but for the publishing. You know, if you've written a book, and you finished it, and you've been working 5 years on getting that book published, but, you know, that's fine. Keep putting stuff out. But you should have written five more books by now. You know, to hold yourself to some really, really strict guidelines of producing, of working, of sitting in the chair and doing the writing and sitting in the chair and doing the marketing and the gaining an audience, because you're running a business as a writer. So, you know, I think writers have been a little bit too gentle with themselves, saying, you know, you wait till the muse strikes and the creativity... It is, but if you're really serious about it as a career, it's also a job, and we need to work it as a job that we take seriously.
That is the best advice, because this is something I always tell authors. I talk to a lot of writing groups and beginning writers, and they'll come to me and they'll be almost finished or nearly finished with their book, and then a few months later they come and they say they're done, and you know they're like, now what? Sending out some query letters. And that's it. They don't understand that it is a business and you have to take it seriously and work it from all ends.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I've done over the last year is I signed up for masterclass.com, which if you've ever been there, it's fantastic. Writers are sharing all of their techniques. You know, David Baldacci is on there. There's also, I signed up for it to watch, you know, screenwriters, since I was starting to do screenwriting. And much like I learned how to build a house with YouTube, I learned how to write a screenplay by masterclass.com. And you can also learn space exploration or how to play tennis or do gymnastics. You know, there's fantastic teachers from the highest level of every industry. And every single one of them in the writing industry, you know, is really, really pushing this. It is a job. It's a job I love. And I love most elements of it. There will also be parts that you don't love, but that you have to continuously be producing. And when you're talking about writing, you know, writers write. It's what you do. It's how you see the world. It's how you express the world and understand the world. And if you're pausing for any reason at all, you know, it's like not breathing. It's like you're not breathing. You're holding your breath. So, yes, send out the query letters. Yes, you should be on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook promoting your work and searching for people to represent you and to build your team because, again, it is a team activity. But you also have to sit your bottom in the chair and be writing something.
And be ready. Well, Kara, I want to thank you so much. I am so – well, actually, I'm so proud of myself that I held out this day. Because I could have like panicked and said I need to book somebody, I need to book anybody, I'll book it, you know, because I was getting really, you know, I don't wait into mid-December to book. So when I got
I'm so
you,
glad
I was,
we
I,
found each other.
Yeah, really, it is. It's just absolutely amazing, and I hope to see you again at some events. And I will definitely keep telling people about you and suggesting if they have a group, an organization that needs inspiration, they should contact you. And I know that you will just make a wonderful speaker. I'm looking forward to, well, I'm not, a major motion picture would be nice, but one of the nice things about, as I envision it as a streaming, is that they'll keep you there, not just as a writer, but also as a technical consultant on how to build a foundation. Hello. Oh, and what the heck, why not, let's do some wiring and you know,
there you go.
You are truly an amazing and inspirational person, and I want to thank you so much. And I want to say a special hello to Hope, Drew, Jada, and Little Roman. Because you guys, you're very lucky. You have a wonderful mother who's just taken you on this fantastic journey that will inspire them also for a lifetime. So, again, thank you so much for joining me today on Joy on Paper. It's an absolute joy to talk to you, Kara.
Well, thank you. You too. And enjoy this launch into the new year.
Okay, I will. Thank you again. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Wow, woo, she is so amazing. And exactly what I said. You know, when I came back from BouchaCon, I was telling you who I remembered. Because most of the people, although some of them are very famous, they weren't memorable because everybody, I would say that 90% of the people at that event, now it was in Dallas and the weather was cold, I grant you. It was an unusually cold time in Dallas, but everybody was dressed in black or muddy brown. Everybody. I mean, I never saw anything like it. It was so boring. And then you'd have a few people who would stand out, a few people who you would notice. And of course, one of the reasons, in addition to the fact that she was always dressed in red, which really, the minute she'd walk in a room, everybody'd turn and they'd say, oh, who's she? You know, that's it. But also because she was always smiling, and I was so surprised at how many people were not smiling. And if you are an author, get out there and smile and make yourself noticeable. I don't know, wear a headband, do something. I think there was one lady who had purple hair, and I never did get to her. She was a sprightly little thing, and she was like walking like one of those Ever-Ready battery bunnies. She was walking so fast I could never catch up to her, and I still don't know who she was, but she was noticeable. But that's what you have to do. If you're an author, it's a business. Just like you would come out with a great sign for your business, you have to come out with a great look for yourself, because you are your own poster. I mean, you're like a walking sign. And if you're going to be dressed completely, I mean, if black is your thing, that's one thing. But if you're just going to be drab so that you're not noticeable or you don't stand out, what's the purpose? Especially when you're on a panel. If you are on a panel, wear yellow, wear orange, wear bright green, wear something that, or even white. But please don't wear muddy brown. I hate muddy brown, and I hate people, or dirty gray. There was a combination of muddy brown and dirty gray. I don't know what's wrong with people. Anyway, have a wonderful, wonderful day today, because I've been really, really, I can't believe it. It's 2020, and I've already got so many things happening. On Tuesday, I have Tasha Alexander and Andrew Grant, and they're going to be on the program. And I did not advertise Larson & Larson today. I will just thank Bill Larson for everything he does. He is our legal eagle, and we'll talk about him on Tuesday. And also Glenn L. Erickson, whose new book, Android Love, is just a wonderful, wonderful book, and he's a great promoter for Joy on Paper. I really appreciate everything he does. And what else? So I've got a lineup for January of incredible, incredible authors, including Nat Geo, author who's going to tell us how to live for, I don't know, he says forever or something like that. Anyway, so that's going to be fun. But remember what I always say. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them in an audible book. Or if you're very lucky, to have those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, a streaming video, or a series on the Hallmark Channel. You never know, and you won't unless you start writing. Meanwhile, say something nice to somebody. I'll say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed. He's saluting me. I'm saluting him. Bye-bye now.